Okay, so if you've ever picked up a big neuroscience textbook,
Oh, yeah, total overwhelm, right?
exactly, and you hear these facts like mammal brains differing in size by 100,000 times, it just feels impossible to synthesize, to get your head around.
It really does. But look, that's kind of why we're doing this deep dive. We're not trying to count every single cell or map every connection.
Right, that's not the goal here.
Our mission today is really about function, architecture. We want to give you like an engineering
That
perspective.
engineering approach. Okay.
Yeah, so you can quickly get the core ideas,
Yeah.
how information actually flows, the key principles. We're focusing on the organization, maybe less on the super deep biochemical detail for now.
Okay, that makes sense. So to do that, we probably need some kind of big picture idea, an organizing principle. And
Yeah.
our sources point towards something, well, maybe a bit foundational, but often overlooked. Cybernetics.
Cybernetics, exactly. It might sound a bit old school, maybe, but it goes back to Norbert Wiener, 1948.
Okay.
And it's all about regulatory systems, communication, control, how things work together, basically, in machines and living things. It gives us a lens.
So for the brain, this cybernetic view means looking at what? Self-organization, how it runs itself.
Self-organization, yeah, autonomy, how the system interacts with its environment. That's the purpose driving the whole structure, you see. It's about control and regulation in response to the world.
All right, so if we're taking an engineering view, there's that classic blueprint from David Moore, right? The three levels for understanding any information processor. How does that map onto the brain using this cybernetic lens?
It maps perfectly. You start top down. Level one is what Marr called the computational level, or what we can call the cybernetic level here.
Okay.
This answers what the system does fundamentally, and maybe more importantly, why. What's the actual problem the brain is trying to solve? What's its goal?
Right, so why does it need to recognize a face or catch a ball, that kind of thing?
Exactly. And once you know the why, you can move down to level two, the algorithmic or representational level.
And this is the how.
This is the how. What steps, what rules, what calculations, what kind of representations does the brain use to actually achieve that goal?
Gotcha, the process.
And then finally, you hit the ground floor, level three, the implementation level.
Ah, the nuts and
The
bolts.
nuts and bolts. How is it physically built? The actual neurons, the synapses, the chemicals, the physical structures that actually run those algorithms you defined at level two.
Okay, that framework makes sense. Top down, why, how, what, with. But there's a really key insight here about how the brain even gets its information, right? Action and perception, they're not separate.
Absolutely not. That's a core cybernetic idea.
Yeah.
Perception isn't just passively receiving data like a camera.
It's active.
It's totally active. It requires you to constantly explore what we call sensory motor affordances.
Affordances, opportunities for action.
Basically, yeah, opportunities the environment offers for you to act. Think about it. Your motor system isn't just outputting commands, it's actively directing your senses.
Like moving your eyes to scan a scene or reaching out to touch something.
Precisely. Your motor system is controlling the flow of information coming in, seeking out what the cortex needs based on potential actions.
So if I see, say, a coffee mug on the table.
Your brain isn't just logging cylinder, white, handle, it's immediately computing the affordance graspable. And your motor system might subtly guide your eyes towards the handle, prioritizing the sensory details needed for that potential action.
Wow. So the motor system is almost programming the sensory system on the fly.
In a way, yes. It's shaping the information-seeking process.
Yeah.
Action and perception are this tight, inseparable loop.
Okay, framework established. Let's zoom out a bit now and look at the actual physical map, the basic layout of the nervous system, quick orientation.
Simplest view first. You've got the CNS, central nervous system, that's the command center, brain and spinal cord.
Right.
And then everything else, all the wiring going out and coming in, that's the PNS, the peripheral nervous system. Nerves, ganglia, the works.
And within that PNS, there's that critical push-pull system, the ANS, right? Autonomic nervous system controls all the stuff we don't consciously think about.
Yeah, it's a beautiful example of cybernetic regulation. You have the sympathetic ANS, think accelerator, arousal, fight or flight, gets your heart pounding, pumps adrenaline.
Gets you ready for action.
And then it's opposite number, the parasympathetic ANS. That's the brake, rest and digest, calms things down, focuses on recovery and conservation.
A constant balancing act.
Exactly. But our sources also mention a sort of third branch, almost like its own mini brain down there.
Ah, yeah, the enteric ANS, the gut brain.
A gut brain. It controls everything related to digestion, like from top to bottom esophagus to colon. And it runs pretty independently a lot of the time.
Which is wild. And that's where all the microbiome interaction is happening too, a whole separate world.
A massive, complex network. It really underscores the distributed nature of control in the body.
Okay, thinking about these different systems, CNS, PNS, ANS, enteric, it forces you to confront the sheer scale of the brain. This is where I think the engineering challenge really becomes clear.
Oh, absolutely. The brain operates across an incredible range of scales. Spatially, you're talking 10 orders of magnitude.
10. So from what to what?
From like individual molecules at the nanometer scale, 10 to the minus 10 meters, all the way up to the whole brain and spinal cord, maybe a meter long.
Nanometers to meters.
And temporally, time-wise, it's even wider, maybe 10 orders of magnitude, perhaps even more. From molecular events happening in tiny fractions of a second, like 10 to the minus 10 seconds.
Whoa.
All the way up to cognitive processes that take seconds or learning that takes much longer.
Wait, so if the brain has to deal with stuff happening almost instantly at the molecular level and stuff happening over seconds at the thought level, how does that even work? What kind of architecture does that force?
It forces a specific kind of architecture. It has to be hierarchical and modular, meaning it needs clear organization at the large scale, different regions, maps, pathways. But it also has to allow for, well, almost chaos at the tiny scale, flexibility down low.
Order emerges from local flexibility.
Sort of. And crucially, this huge scale difference means the brain can't just use one communication method. It needs two parallel systems.
Okay, what are they?
You've got fixed specialized projections. Think of these as dedicated phone lines, direct wires between specific areas for fast, precise signaling.
Point to point.
Exactly. But you also need diffuse interactions. This is more like broadcasting broad chemical signals like neurotransmitters and hormones that wash over large areas and change the overall state or context.
So specific calls and general announcements, basically.
That's a good way to put it. Both are essential to manage information across those vast scales.
Okay, let's dive into that chemistry then, the diffused interaction side. The neuron doctrine basic idea is neurons are the core cells, right? And they can last your whole life.
Pretty much, yeah. Specialized cells, very long-lived. But here's a kicker. Thinking about energy and activity.
Yeah.
Despite the brain being this energy hog, consuming maybe 20% of your body's power.
It's incredibly efficient.
It seems to be. On average, only about 1% of your neurons are firing really actively at any given moment. The overall average firing rate is surprisingly low, around 2 hertz, 2 times per second.
Only 2 hertz. Wow. So it's mostly quiet.
It maintains a low baseline activity, likely for energy conservation and maybe signal clarity.
And that careful balance, that low activity is maintained right down at the connection points, the synapses, that gap where the chemicals flow.
That's the key battleground. A neuron fires, sends a spike, releases neurotransmitters across that tiny synaptic gap.
And how well that signal gets across, that's the synaptic weight we hear about in AI models.
Exactly. That efficiency is the synaptic weight. And it's controlled by specific chemistry, creating a fundamental balance.
The push and pull.
The push and pull. For excitation, making the next neuron more likely to fire, the on switch, you primarily use glutamate. It mainly works by opening channels for positive ions, like sodium, Na+.
Okay, glutamate excites. What inhibits? What's the off switch?
That's mainly GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It typically works by opening channels for negative ions, like chloride, Cl, making the neuron less likely to fire.
So glutamate steps on the gas, GABA hits the brakes, keep things from going haywire.
Precisely. This constant balance prevents runaway excitation, which you see in things like seizures.
But beyond that basic gas and brake system, there are these other chemicals, right? The ones that act more like global state controllers, the diffuse signals we talked about.
Yes, the neuromodulators. They don't just flip a single switch. They change the overall tone or sensitivity of large parts of the network. Our sources highlight four really key ones you should know.
Okay, lay them on me.
First up, norepinephrine, also called noradrenaline. Think. Alertness, attention.
So it's not carrying specific data. It's more like turning up the volume for the whole system, waking it up.
Exactly. It gets the brain ready to process incoming information effectively. Then you have serotonin.
The mood molecule.
Often linked to mood, yeah.
Yeah.
Seems to regulate general emotional tone, baseline stability, implicated heavily in depression and anxiety.
Okay. And dopamine.
This one's famous for reward, but it's much broader. Crucial for motivation, deciding to initiate actions, movement control, and learning what's valuable or important.
So reward, but also action and learning. Got it. And the last one.
Acetylcholine. This one is really vital for things like memory formation, learning consolidation, and overall plasticity, the brain's ability to change.
So these four, norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, they show how the brain uses broad chemical signals to shift the entire computational landscape, not just flip individual bits.
Perfectly put. It's that dual system again. Fast, specific electrical signals on wires, and slower, broad chemical modulation setting the context.
All right, we've got the cybernetic why, the chemical how for diffuse signals. Let's look at the main computational structure. The cortex.
Mm-hmm.
The big, wrinkly outer layer.
Yeah, the star of the show in many ways. It's actually surprisingly thin, only about 1.5 to 4 millimeters thick.
Really? That thin?
Yep, but it's highly folded, convoluted, which packs a huge surface area, maybe 2,500 square centimeters into your skull.
Wow. And it's layered, right?
It is. The neocortex, the newest part evolutionarily, typically has six distinct layers. Older parts, like the paleocortex and archicortex, might have three or four. Each layer has different cell types and connection patterns.
And it's not just layers. There's a vertical organization, too. Columns.
Columns are key. The thinking is that the basic functional unit isn't just one neuron, but a mini column, maybe around 100 neurons working together vertically through the layers.
Okay, a little processing unit.
And these mini columns seem to cluster into larger units called hypercolumns, sometimes called macrocolumns, maybe around 30,000 neurons in a hypercolumn, handling a specific aspect of processing, like orientation and vision.
So layers and columns. A grid-like processing structure.
It's structured, yeah. And this structure underpins the function of the large-scale divisions we can see the lobes.
Okay, let's map those four big visible lobes. Not as totally separate boxes, but as specialized zones. Let's start at the front, the prefrontal and frontal lobes, the CEO.
You could call it that. It's the executive control center. High-level planning, complex decision-making, working memory, motivation.
Thinking about the future.
Absolutely. Predicting consequences of actions is huge. Also, social behavior, understanding norms, inhibiting inappropriate responses. And interestingly, it's also involved in storing learned motor sequences, like riding a bike or playing piano. Muscle memory lives there too.
Okay, so the planner and controller. To plan, it needs good info about the world and where we are in it.
Mm-hmm.
That brings us to the lobe sitting behind it, on top, the parietal lobe.
Right. The parietal lobe is the great integrator, especially for spatial awareness. It processes touch, pain, temperature, your sense of body position, proprioception.
Where your limbs are.
Exactly. And crucially, it integrates this bodily sense with vision and other senses. It tells the frontal lobe where things are in relation to you, so you can plan actions like reaching. It's also key for navigation and even abstract concepts like mathematics.
Integrates senses, figures out space.
Got it.
Then, moving to the back, the occipital lobe. Pretty specialized.
Almost entirely dedicated to vision, processing the raw data from your eyes, color, motion, shape, depth. It's the primary visual processing center.
Okay, the visual input processor. And lastly, tucked into the sides by the temples, the temporal lobe.
Temporal lobe handles a lot. Hearing, obviously, processing sound and language comprehension. Also crucial for high-level visual processing, like object recognition, figuring out what you're seeing, linking it to memory. And vital for verbal memory, plus smell analysis.
Okay, that covers the main surface areas. But so much critical control happens underneath the cortex, right? Let's talk about the central relay station first, the thalamus.
The thalamus is absolutely central. Think of it as the main gateway to the cortex. Almost all sensory information, sight, sound, touch, taste, even internal body sense, interoception, goes through the thalamus first.
Except smell, right? That one's different.
Smell has a more direct route initially, yeah, but eventually connects in. But basically, the thalamus is the major input hub. And it's not just input. It handles output from the cortex, too. These constant corticothalamic loops are running.
Loops? What are they doing? Why loop back and forth?
It seems to be a fundamental mechanism for filtering and prediction. The cortex sends down expectations or predictions to the thalamus. The thalamus compares incoming sensory data to those predictions.
Like checking if reality matches the expectation.
Sort of. It helps filter the overwhelming sensory flood, focus attention, and stabilize perception. It's a continuous dialogue, not just a one-way street.
Fascinating. Okay, moving deeper into those older, more primal structures, often grouped as the limbic system. Emotion, memory, drive. First up, the hippocampus.
Hippocampus means seahorse because of its shape. It's critical for fast learning, particularly forming new episodic memories, memories of events, the what, where, when, and also spatial memory and navigation, building cognitive maps of your surroundings.
The memory recorder and mapmaker, right next door, the amygdala, often gets a bad rap for fear.
It's heavily involved in processing emotions, particularly fear, yes, but also other strong emotions like pleasure or anger. Crucially, it attaches emotional significance or affective value to stimuli and memories. It learns what's dangerous, what's rewarding.
So it tags experiences with emotional importance.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Then there's the basal ganglia. More about movement.
Yes, but not just executing movement. It's heavily involved in learning and selecting sequences of actions, forming habits, motor control, and crucially, initiating new activities or switching between tasks. It helps you decide which action to perform next based on context and potential reward. It's key for smooth, goal-directed behavior and anticipation.
Okay, hippocampus for memory, amygdala for emotion tagging, basal ganglia for action selection. But there's one more subcortical structure, sometimes called the hidden fifth lobe, the insula. What's its deal?
The insula is tucked away deep inside. It's profoundly important for interoception.
Feeling your internal body state.
Exactly. Awareness of your heartbeat, your breathing, gut feelings, pain, temperature. It translates the physical state of your body into subjective feelings. Think nausea, disgust, empathy, cravings, that visceral sense of how you feel physically and emotionally. It bridges body and mind.
A gut feeling generator. Wow. Okay, so we have all these specialized regions, the cortex, the thalamus, the limbic structures, all doing their thing, running these loops. What actually pulls it all together into the unified experience we call consciousness? How does one thing win out?
The big question. The key player here seems to be a network called the Extended Reticular Thalamic System, or ERTIS. It involves parts of the brainstem, reticular formation, and the thalamus.
ERTIS. And it's needed for being awake and aware.
Essentially, yes. It's required for maintaining the normal, conscious waking state. It seems to manage the overall level of arousal and attention.
And how does it create that single stream of awareness? What's the functional idea?
The idea, often called global broadcasting or similar concepts, is that sensory inputs and internal signals are constantly competing for access, likely within this ERTIS network and related cortical areas.
A competition.
If one particular piece of information, one representation, wins this competition, perhaps because it's strongest, most relevant, or attended to, it gets amplified.
And broadcast.
And broadcast widely across many different brain areas. This global message becomes the current content of your conscious experience, allowing different specialized modules to access and process that single dominant piece of information.
So consciousness is like the winning message getting put on the global loudspeaker for all departments to hear.
That's a pretty good analogy, yeah. It creates that unified subjective field out of all the parallel processing.
But, you know, it's important to remember, not everything needs that global broadcast, right? The brain is efficient.
Oh, absolutely. Loads of stuff happens without conscious awareness. Think about simple reflexes.
Like the knee-jerk reflex at the doctor's.
Exactly. Or pulling your hand away from something hot before you even feel the pain consciously.
How does that work so fast?
It bypasses the brain, essentially. The sensory signal goes from, say, your hand up to the spinal cord. In the spinal cord, it connects directly or via just one intermediary neuron, an interneuron, to a motor neuron going back down to your muscle.
Sensory in, quick connection in the spine, motor out, no brain required.
No higher brain processing needed for the reflex itself. It's a fast, fixed, local circuit designed for rapid protection or response. Shows that efficiency principle, again, don't bother the CEO with routine stuff.
What a journey. Okay, so we started with this engineering, cybernetic view, Mars levels, telling us to think why, how, what, with.
Right. Defining the problem, the algorithm, the implementation.
Then we saw how the brain's massive scale forces this dual architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Fast, fixed wires for specific jobs, and these broad, diffuse chemical signals like serotonin, dopamine, to change the whole state.
It's the end of the context, yeah.
We mapped the lobes, frontal for planning, parietal for space, occipital for vision, temporal for hearing and meaning, and dove underneath to the thalamus, the great router.
The limbic system for memory and emotion, basal ganglia for action, the insula for gut feelings.
And finally, how the ERTIS might create consciousness through this competitive global broadcasting.
Yeah, the core idea really is this dual control system, electrical precision locally, chemical modulation globally, all working together for regulation and efficient processing across incredible scales.
Understanding these principles, this functional organization, feels absolutely critical, especially now, with everyone trying to build intelligent machines, which leads perfectly into this final thought we wanted to leave you with from Jeff Hawkins back in 2020.
Yeah, he put it very directly. We'll never have true AI without first understanding the brain.
Think about that. If we still don't fully grasp the fundamental principles of how our intelligence works, the control, the organization, the integration of action and perception, how can we really expect to build something truly autonomous, adaptable, and, well, intelligent?
It's a huge challenge, something definitely worth mulling over.